Okay, welcome back. So we've got half an hour to talk about materiality and the results of your deliberations. Why don't we start with the climate risk first? Something that we didn't get a chance to do in our session when we covered tax. So Gary and Rachel, you led the two teams on that. So you want to go first, Rachel?
I can do. Yes, we had a fairly broad-ranging discussion in our group. I'm not entirely certain that we got round to actually answering the questions. but having said that, when we looked back at what the discussion actually was, what we seem to have done is actually touched on most of the sort of four-step process that was outlined in the paper, in that we talked about quite extensively about this idea of identifying user needs, which is the first step in the process. And we had a little bit of a debate about whether actually that's the right, how we should go about that first starting point, whether what we should be doing is sitting down and generally sort of identifying user needs, or whether actually what we should be doing is taking the context of the financial statements and looking at what IFRS requires, looking to comply with that and meet users' needs in respect to the information required by IFRS, and then perhaps have an overlay of looking at user needs. And I think there was probably a bit of a split between the preparers and the users in the room in terms of which way round made more sense. I think the users were probably saying that actually what we wanted to do is for you to sit down and look at what the investors' needs are in sort of totality and then start going through the whole process, whereas I think the preparers were more looking at, well, we need to do this in the context of the financial statements and the requirements of IFRS and then look at how within that context we can meet users' needs. I think there was also a discussion around there about this, about where our boundary, if you like, is between the information required in a set of financial statements versus the sort of information that you might want to see in a broader financial report, so in the management commentary, in MD&A, something like that, and saying that particularly the example that we were looking at, which was climate risk, is quite a difficult one because there are clearly some things in respect to climate risk which will affect the assets and liabilities, the income and expenses that you are actually reporting in the financial statements, but there are also sort of broader climate risks that you might expect to see some disclosures about and users indeed might want to see the information about, but the question was, does that actually fit within the financial statements or is it something you would expect to see somewhere but not necessarily in the financial statements? I think one thing where there was quite a lot of agreement within the group on was this idea that there needs to be communication between the investors, the users of the financial report, and the preparers to get a better understanding of what sorts of things you would expect to see in the financial statements versus what things are actually possibly not necessary, not needed. So this idea of communication between people, I think, came out quite heavily there. In terms of the step two, where we were talking about how to make a materiality judgment, there was probably less discussion around this area, but I think one of the things that that came out quite strongly there was the need to think very carefully about entity-specific factors, and that actually this notion of providing sort of boilerplate information in the financial statements isn't particularly helpful to users, that you really need to think about what are the risks that this particular entity is facing and what are going to be important information in respect to this entity, not just generalized risks that everybody is facing. So again, we touched on that idea. The third step in the whole process is around organising the information, and we did indeed have a discussion around that, that actually one of the most important things about communicating information in the financial statements very clearly is to organise the information in a way that makes sense to the users of the financial statements. There were some examples there used of if you're looking at individual cash generating units, you probably want to see the information that's relevant to the particular cash generating units all in one place rather than perhaps spread out all over the financial report. So the idea that you think very carefully about how you organise the information. We very briefly touched on review of the financial report, so the fourth step, and the point that was made that actually this does capture the idea that the compilation of a set of financial statements and the materiality judgments that are needed to put together the financial statements is really an iterative process. You need to go through that process and think carefully about the whole balance of the information in the financial report. So I think there's a general agreement with that step four. At the end, I did sort of say, well, I was going to be in trouble if we hadn't actually answered the question, so I asked for a show of hands as to whether the four-step process seemed to capture the sort of judgments that needed to be made when going through and thinking about materiality. And I think there was general agreement that it's along the right sort of lines of the sorts of things that you need to think about in terms of making materiality judgments. Now, I'm sure I have missed out lots of very important things, so if the members of my group would like to sort of weigh in with anything significant that I've missed, then please do. In fact, anything material that I've missed.
Not by the look of it. Okay, good. Thank you, Rachel. Karen?
Okay, thank you. Like Rachel's group, we spent most of our time on the climate change, quickly touched on taxes, but in honesty, probably didn't get a fulsome discussion on it. Is going through the four-step process, considering that the reporting entity is an airline, probably highly leveraged, whether by leasing or by mortgages. We concluded the primary users are probably equally both the common shareholders and the mortgagees or lessees or so on. So we think creditors and ordinary shareholders are probably equally weighted. Important primary users. We didn't try to extend, beyond that at this point. We actually had surprising amount of consensus in the room. And generally, I think the view was none of this belongs in the financial statements at this time. That it's all useful information, probably belongs in the management commentary under that practice statement, or it belongs in, say, risk factors. But the strong view certainly the prepared community, but I believe the investor, notice singular Goro, we seconded Fred to make it only a 4-2 imbalance discussion. But I think generally agreed is that, yes, much of the stuff is what is the proposed legislation, what might the price of refitting your engines be, what might the impacts of cap and trade be. Those are all extremely useful. They don't make the definition of IAS 37, either as actual or even contingent liabilities at this point, because the legislation is proposed. It's not enacted, waiting to have an effective date and so on. So everyone agrees useful, but does not belong in the financial statements. So you'd argue it's not just immaterial, it's inappropriate at this point in time. We did differentiate between questions A and B about proposed legislation versus C, which is potential future legislation. Everyone agreed potential future legislation is just that. It's something that might happen but hasn't happened yet. Proposed legislation, at least something in the public domain, but absent knowing a lot more about the legal status of it. Has it been passed, just waiting for the PM or the head of the European Union to sign it, which they've said they will, versus it's just sitting in legislative committee and so on. So you need to know more about that. Certainly people, to the extent this company or any company had some indications the monetary effects would again be useful, the risk factors or MD&A, but not in the financial statements. So with concluding at this point in time, it doesn't belong in the financial statements. There really was not much of a need to talk about question three about how to organize it, because organize it as if it's not there. But stepping back, looking at, I'll call it a balanced view, for the statements, all we thought we belongs in the risk factors and or MD&A, as the case may be. At the same time, other questions we added to the list. You certainly want to know, how can you mitigate these costs? What is your ability to pass along in pricing? Because presumably these impacts affect all airlines, therefore all your competitors are affected equally. So either if you have the ability to pass along in pricing, that's a mitigation. It's also something useful to know. If no one can pass along in pricing, that's also useful to know. But again, it's MD&A. And I think in this case, both the user and the prepared community is largely aligned. Good to know, but not in the audited financial statements. And the other comment about disclosing information on proposed legislation. Multinationals operate in dozens of countries, if not more. There's always proposed legislation, you know, much of which is not likely to be beneficial to a company. And it would be impractical to impossible to chase around all the legislation, both, you know, in regional trade blocks, say like the EU, individual countries, provinces, and states within countries, and so on. It's just not doable.
Okay, thanks. And you mentioned that you had a brief discussion about taxes.
The essence of taxes, we only did that in the last 8 or 10 minutes, we really want to know about the big items that really draw a 25% parent company rate down to about 10%. What's the sustainability of those? You had two very big foreign items in there, foreign tax rate differential and one-time grants or credits from or tax incentives. How sustainable are they? And you would not know that from the tax reconciliation. You know, the sense is the financial statements probably should give some further if not a prediction, at least indications of the source of those, what they're related to, and so on. And that's about as far as we got.
Okay, good. Turn that further.
Okay. Our group were discussing the tax reconciliation note, and I think probably could have discussed for about 3 hours more, because we really did have to cut ourselves short. There was some comments. If I start first of all with a discussion about what the users are looking for and what they need, there was comment about the importance of identifying what the user wants, but not just that, about what the user wants it for, and the recognition that there needs to be a fair use by the user. Rather than simply the fact that there is some information that they're interested in. And so perhaps that's something that we can pick up in terms of the practice statement in emphasizing the purposes to which the information is being used, as well as the fact that it is the primary user. We had some comments about some of the main challenges when it comes to materiality, and in particular the challenges with discussions with auditors, between preparers and auditors, and the hurdle for excluding information, and is that the same as the hurdle for including information? The notion that a question that was raised both in terms of from the preparers and the investors was, well, where is the starting point? And preparers would note that the auditors audit to the standards, so therefore the standards form a starting point from that perspective, given that that's the frame of reference. But perhaps a concern that some users might have that might be too narrow a focus if the starting point is simply the what's required by the standards. There was a general comment about the information that is included in the financial statements giving weak signals, and that there could be either a problem with information missing completely, or there may be information that's in there but it's simply buried in amongst other information. So I guess there's an element here. I mean, it clearly fits within the identifying information to be included and then the organization of that information within there. But I think something that we need to think about both from the point of view of materiality but also from principles of disclosure and organizing the information. we talked only a little bit about the actual tax reconciliation example, but I think there was general agreement from both preparers and users that there was a lot of noise that was included in the example that we had given, and that really what is important is explaining why the effective rate is different from the tax rate, and certainly from the users in the room explaining is it sustainable, or commenting on is it sustainable or not. And so it certainly struck me that there were, you know, two key elements that could be identified as being sort of the important, the objectives, if you like, for the tax reconciliation. And yet when you compare it with the long list of disclosures, you shall disclose this, shall disclose that, it sort of begs the question as to, well, how can we move the focus onto what's really important, and how do we do that in through the practice statement, or is there more that we need to do beyond that? The members of the group that I was discussing with, is there anything more that you'd like to add with regards to reporting back on our discussion?
Maybe one thing, the four-step approach does not really explicitly maybe in the end it looks back at the are you satisfied with the results, but there's like it could be explicit, does the requirements of IFRS satisfy the information needs of users, and it could well be that the requirements of IFRS does not reach that objective. And there should be like a clear what information beyond IFRS should be included because it is material, because it starts off with what is material for users. And I think that first question should not be taken within IFRS, but outside IFRS. Just start with what is appropriate to report on taxes for your company, and then look what's required by IFRS and what's not required for IFRS but should also be provided, or which may be considered to be provided as well.
There are disclosure requirements in IAS 12, and absolutely agree that they may not be sufficient, but of course IAS 1 does require a company to consider what additional information may be necessary to satisfy the information needs of users. So, I mean, this came up in our group as well. Is the information provided in that role, in that reconciliation, sufficient to understand the tax position? I think Peter was arguing in a very similar way, well, probably not, and we do need, there's perhaps more information that should be disclosed, but IAS 1 arguably does cover it, so it's not as though it's not outside IFRS as such. But of course, if it's more general, yeah, that requirement, it's perhaps more difficult to apply.
It's, there's always a boundary, should it be in a management report or in a financial report, and for example, what's your tax policy? It's very relevant, but yeah, it's also a question, where should it be, indeed, that's presentation, or where, what's the appropriate location? But I agree with you.
Well, our group had a similar discussion by the sound of it. I think we focused perhaps more on the tax note, and Peter took us there at the beginning because he identified the information needs of investors, the effective tax rate and the cash taxes, and pointed out that he felt that the note as presented wasn't sufficient, and the foreign tax situation came up as a key driver of those of the effective tax rate. Some of the preparers perhaps felt that maybe some of the numbers could have been combined. Trying to go further in the foreign taxes is difficult because of the complexity in that particular area. But we had a lot of discussion about whether there should be more or less disaggregation of this and different types of reconciliation provided. We didn't really get into the four-point plan. I think in effect we were using it because we were talking about information needs, we were talking about the step two and trying to identify whether specific numbers are material or not. We did stand back at the end and think about the overall impact. So whilst we didn't come up with a yes or no, the 4 points work, I don't think anything we did contradicted the 4 points, and I think implicitly we were going through those. but the other points you made, I think, are also valid. Anybody want to add from our group?
So, I have a question to you. Where do you go from here now? Because the most important point which came in our group is this, that this starting point of this reconciliation is 12. Now, I mean, if it is not being covered by IFRS and a separate reconciliation is required between the effective tax rate and the standard tax rate, how do you achieve that? I mean, at the moment, there is nothing in the existing standard. So does it mean that we make a move for changing the standard? Does it mean that we make a general guidance note that because it is important, therefore it is necessary to be? Where do we go from here?
And the one of the things that came up in our group was the fact that a standard might say you shall disclose A, B, and C. But it might be that you conclude that A and C are material, but B isn't. So therefore, the materiality practice statement should help a preparer to make that judgment and also then simply disclose A and C and not disclose B. Now, the materiality practice statement, I think, could achieve that without needing to have a change to the standard that changes the wording in the standard. Because thinking back to what we've already got in IFRS about the fact that standards, the requirements of standards apply to material information, then what I could see this as trying to do is to complete that circle in helping people say, well, look, you know, if I've gone through this, made this judgment that something isn't material, the fact that the standard says you shall disclose means that really it's shall disclose if material, and I've been able to satisfy myself that it is not material, so therefore I don't need to disclose. So I see this as being something that we need to try and incorporate it or make sure is clear in the practice statement. And I think some examples in the practice statement could help us with that without necessarily needing to make changes to the disclosure requirements in the standards themselves.
I think the need was different. Is it possible, just a suggestion, is it possible to recommend an optional, it's an optional requirement that you may, in addition to this reconciliation, you may also give a reconciliation between the effective tax rate and the standard tax rate.
When you say reconciliation between effective and standard tax rate?
Why is it, for example, a company has been enjoying certain benefits in certain geographies?
But that is the requirement of IS 12. So there is a requirement to have a reconciliation of the standard tax rate, 25% in this case, and the effective tax rate, and it gives two alternative ways of doing it. What it doesn't give is a minimum line items in that reconciliation. That's up to you to decide what those line items should be. But there is already a requirement to do that reconciliation, subject to materiality.
Some
and
clarifications on that we may consider. Okay. In order to capture the point which was discussed in the group.
Richard? This four-step process, I think, worked okay in the examples we were looking at. I do have an issue in how it works in other situations. And the one I'm thinking of in particular, for a manufacturing company and IFRS 7. I had this discussion with our auditors that I think all the IFRS 7 disclosure is completely immaterial, or in fact misleading. And I don't think this process helps you through that discussion. I can maybe give you an example. If you have a plant in one country, exporting to another country, and you hedge 40% of the anticipated transactions. IFRS 7 leads you to disclose the risks on the 40% of the hedging transactions, which I think anybody that was trying to look at the risks in that would say your risk is in the percent that you haven't hedged. And really, giving all kinds of information about sensitivity on the hedging items is complete clutter, and is taking away from any risk that you should be talking about. And I don't think this process helps address that kind of materiality issue in a standard like IFRS 7.
We had a long discussion when we did the hedge accounting on how that disclosure should work, and in fact we originally proposed that the disclosure should be about the unhedged risk on advice from many of the investors, but it got resoundingly trashed by many in the comment letter process, and we dropped it. Doesn't mean to say that you don't that you couldn't disclose that information. I personally think it's very important that, to have that disclosure, but that deliberately wasn't a requirement in the standard.
Yeah, but so my issue is there's a lot of clutter in the financial statements then about sensitivities on these items which are not really measuring the risk, so that I would argue that was all immaterial and should be taken out. And certainly our auditors had a completely different view.
And what drove their view?
The numbers were big. And it was an IFRS requirement and the numbers were big.
Okay, so your argument was that it's not relevant to the understanding of the financial statements?
Yes.
Michael, how does that work in this four-point plan?
We're talking here about, I think, step two, which is making the materiality judgment about this information. And so for me the question would be, well, is it therefore going to give useful information to investors to help them with their objective of trying to estimate what sort of their returns on their investment are going to be? So if the answer is yes, it is going to be helpful and relevant for them, then that would seem to lead me in the direction of yes, you would disclose, and if it isn't, then you wouldn't need to on the grounds of materiality. So that would then bring you back to, well, do the factors that we've got here draw out the relevant points to make that particular judgment? And obviously one of the area where we start with is the quantitative factors, and you say that it was the quantitative dimension of it that the auditors were focusing in on. And so what is it about the quantitative factor that they were focusing on? How does that match up with what we are sort of highlighting here? And perhaps more importantly, how does it relate to your assessment of the quantitative dimension? So what was it about it that you concluded was not sufficiently of quantitative importance that the users need to be informed about it?
Well, IFRS 7 is about disclosure about risk, mm-hmm. of, in this case, of a currency plan for the sales in a foreign currency. So, but the only required disclosures are about financial instruments, which were actually the hedging instruments. So you were disclosing completely the wrong information. But the hedging instruments themselves were material.
Mm. I mean, there's I guess the two sides of the coin. I mean, you've identified there's the other side that wasn't required to be disclosed through IFRS 7, and clearly, you know, if you identify that as being material, then disclosing that would be relevant and consistent with IS 1. And then in the context, and maybe this is part of the sort of the step four, the sort of stand back, does it The fact that if you've given the disclosure on the bit that isn't specified by the standard, because you've identified that that is relevant and important, does it give you more insight then into what IFRS 7 has said you should be disclosing? Because actually, when looked at as a whole, those disclosures about the risks on the hedging side are not giving useful information and therefore don't need to be given. So I wonder whether it's this would be something that would come up in that fourth step as helping you to conclude and to discuss with the auditor as to whether it's really needed.
Let's get some more comments. Kevin.
Sandra was before me.
If you have a comment on what he was talking about, okay. When I look at the steps, step three seems out of place amongst the others, three steps. Step one, two, and four are more about determining if something is material. And the organization is almost, an application of materiality, determining where it should be presented and how it should be presented. So it's almost like you're mixing two processes together in your four-step model.
Okay, good point. Kevin?
It hasn't come up during this period. We discussed it at the beginning of the day before we all came together. Another caution on the shalls and shoulds and so forth. In that materiality judgment process, paragraph D is the information about a related party transaction. A regulator's going to go, there you go, it's in the practice statement, the ISB says all related party transactions are material. And so try and avoid any reference to a specific statement, be a more glib, is it sort of, I say, a regulatory requirement or something else, as opposed to a specific standard, because the regulators will use it to beat us up.
Now, we put that in because some people would say that the fact that a transaction, for example, does involve a related party, that the fact that it involves a related party is relevant and useful information. That was our thinking behind putting this in. It sounds from, are you challenging that?
Yes. And I'll give an example for us the last year end. We entered into a related party transaction with a company of our chairman. The fee was $50,000. The auditors compelled me to disclose it. Now, we are $5 billion turnover. That type of number at that level is definitely not material. And that type of phrase, in our perception, even though it is a related party, and that type of phraseology doesn't help me in that argument that $50,000 commission.
But would you assess materiality of that type of transaction the same as the materiality of a transaction with a non-related party?
Yeah, because it was the fact that his company, the fact that he never participated in the discussion process, it was never even raised at our board because it was all within the delegated of authority at the person that's there. I didn't see how it could ever have been material, but that viewpoint is becoming very pervasive, principally driven by the PCAOB and their current audit standard guidance on related party, that every related party transaction is material. And that fundamentally is not true.
It's the same thing here. We've gone through similar experiences. And currently the standard, say that the standard on related parties is supposed to provide insight into whether related party transactions are material to the financial statements. There is no governance objective in the standard. Some regulators like to see a governance aspect in the reporting. Now you guys can either add or drop through a due process, add a governance aspect to it. But as long as the standard is as it is materiality to financial statements. And yeah, I'm with you that if it's a related party, I need to consider that in my materiality assessment, but not at the level that some regulators do now, which is the materiality level is zero because it is a related party transaction. I may rather go through something like, is it material to us or the related party? Because if it's material to the related party, it may impact the decisions. Could it impact the decisions? But if I get to something like it's immaterial to the company, it's immaterial to the related party, there's no way that this transaction could impact decisions of the related party, well, then I don't disclose it. But regulators currently go, no, you disclose everything to the penny if it's about related parties. And that's when I read it, I was concerned. If you have something like this in this paper, in the current heat of the debate around that, you start to take a position in this debate. And if you want to take a position in this debate, you should not do it through such a paper. Whether you should take a position is a very different question. But if you intend to take a position, do it through other means than through a graph in such a paper. But with this, you take a position if you keep it in there.
Well, we're taking the position that this is a qualitative factor that could influence your decision about materiality. We're not taking a position about what the regulator says. That's up to them. If they want to apply a $1 materiality threshold, they can do it.
Now, be aware that regulators will take this paper and stick it under preparers' noses, here with the eyes be confirmed that there is no materiality, because that there is a different materiality and that this is zero. They will use it, and that's only a warning, a course, be cautious with it. With this, you start to get part of a hot debate that is currently on, and I don't know whether you want to be part of this hot debate.
Because, Stephen, you then, it begs into Richard's comment, you then, why do you have it? Is this information about hedging? Is this, it's a long list that you create, and here you've selected just one.
So should we put more in?
No, but you shouldn't have any. You should just have, are there other qualitative factors that are entity specific, that using an IES1 catch-all type phrase rather than pick a standard and include a standard.
What
did
the investors think,
Marietta? Just a very high-level comment. I mean, I do think the four-step process is very clear, and a lot of people find it very helpful. What I think would also be helpful is if you actually had more guidance in the practice statement as to what are you going to do with the findings coming out of that process, especially if the finding is that you identify qualitative risks. Because I think where there seemed to be a lot of confusion in our groups, and I think in other groups maybe as well, is if you've identified a sort of relatively intangible risk like climate change, what do you then actually do with it? And there was a lot of discussion about, well, it's inappropriate to actually list risk factors in the primary financial statements. And my original understanding of the materiality debate had been that, that's not really what you're trying to do. Maybe you want to list the risk factor somewhere else. But for purposes of the financial statements, what would then be interesting for me would be to actually have, in terms of the breakdown of the revenues and the costs, to understand those components that might potentially be subject to climate risks, how big are they? And then I can make up my own mind whether the proposed legislation is likely to come through or not. So I think to me it was never about talking in the primary financial statements about proposed legislation. It's about, just what level of granularity in terms of the revenues and costs do you want to split out, and what should be driving that decision. And so I think some guidance around how to use those findings from the process would be quite helpful.
So I think the objective of this whole exercise is to provide better disclosure, and I think there is, reluctantly, I think the users will acknowledge that there can be too much or inappropriate disclosure. So I think the objective is clear. I think the four steps is a nice start, but I think some of these conversations clearly show that there's more work to be done. I certainly wouldn't want it to be used as a hammer to start getting a whole bunch of extra disclosure. I'm interested about this, about the related party, because I think a $50,000 could be extremely material, but I recognize that you could go through a whole exercise and say, no, it's not material, but the dollar amount is irrelevant. You could have a $10 material transaction. One of the interesting things I noticed in our conversation is that almost the best defense that something is immaterial is that there was something else that was material. And we've heard this coming up a couple of times. In our tax tech section, we said this, a lot of the stuff was immaterial, we wanted this. We heard the comment that the hedging information is not material, it's the unhedged information that's immaterial. So that's an interesting thought, that this almost opens up a question of, it's almost as if, prepares don't hit me, it's almost as if you get to not disclose something by arguing that you should be disclosing something else. Good start, but there's a lot of work to do.
Okay. Thank you, Sandra.
And I was looking at the flow chart and the materiality judgment process, the entity-specific qualitative factors and environmental qualitative factors could imply that you're looking for more risk factor type information in the base financial statements, and it goes back to some of the stuff that I had talked about in our breakout section, that forward-looking really belongs more in a management commentary. Risk factors probably belong outside the base financial statements themselves, and this may be crossing the line into some of those types of things. I think if you keep it within the context of the financial statements themselves and the historical information, and think about these things, it may be helpful, but I'm a little concerned that it could push you to expand into a lot more disclosures in the base financial statements.
So thinking about environmental entity-specific factors might help you decide whether that specific piece of historical information is material or not.
Right.
But it shouldn't be read as looking for a whole load of new information about future risks and potential future business changes.
That's right, and I have a fear that could push companies to end up disclosing a lot more information.
Kevin's fear that merely mentioning related parties will push regulators to say, here we are, you've got to give all this information about related parties. Marta?
Yeah, I heard some pushback on the organize the information step three. I do think that maybe organize is maybe not the right word, but setting level of granularity is very important, also for materiality. And I'm not sure whether this step should be taken out. Presenting the information, I do feel that somehow presentation does matter in materiality. So maybe granularity, or I'm not sure if organized should be taken out, or maybe it should be named differently, but it's
Okay, we're running over, eating into your lunch. But interesting discussion, thank you for your input. I think Michael, you got some interesting comments.
Very useful comments, yeah.
After